Thursday, Thomas's fourth lecture, followed by Thomas's second dinner. Cut all that out.
So, still great to be here. Let me remind you what we have covered so far. So the first lecture, I gave some overview of what we know about the common unit of fixed modular space by studying this direction. So some of those ideas will have effect today as well. What you must recall from there is that we had this idea of semi-projective varieties, and they have a particularly nice host structure. They have a pure host structure, which you can prove by those geometrical arguments. Like they interact to their core, which is a projective sub-variety, and because the total space is smooth, the Wieser structure is very nice on them. And then if you have such a pure thing, then you know that if you can compute the E polynomial, and then I showed you this finite field technique in the previous lecture, and today I will show you in a different form. But we will be now in a situation where we will know that the variety has a pure cohomology because basically it's semi-projective. And so in these cases, the technique will work out much stronger than previously. Although the previous one, we had a nice count, but then we managed to have a conjecture for the Mistoch polynomial, and it's very interesting. It seems to have a lot of connections in many other things, but we still cannot prove that. In this lecture, most of the things are now proved, so that's an advantage of varieties which have such a pure cohomology. Okay, so how did we got to pure varieties? Is that so interesting? I mean, one thing, of course, is that that's another family of interesting hyperkeeler varieties, like the modular space of these bundles. So it was always some of the things I was looking at. But in fact, I will not again won't have time to talk about this. This is what that usually goes by the name of purity conjectures. But the idea, roughly, is that through the character varieties we study, for now I haven't had any kind of ramification, so in this case we just attach to such a character variety a quiver. In this case, which we studied so far, to the geometry surface, we attach a quiver with G loops. And then the general conjectures about purity says that the pure part of the cohomology of this should be the cohomology of a pure variety attached to this quiver, roughly speaking. And indeed, that has a lot of checks, and for all the research polynomials we have computed, one of the other checks, which is also making it stronger, is to look at the pure part and show that it has to do with some sort of pure varieties. That's how we got to them first. But then it independently became interesting because we had this finite field technique. We managed to compute the cohomology of a large class of these pure varieties. So this talk behind you not mention character varieties, only pure varieties. And at the end, in the last slide, I'll show you a very nice recent work of Schiffman where he uses the same ideas, but technically much more difficult way to get the first most polynomial for the Poincaré polynomial of fixed modular spaces, which is one of our main concerns in these lectures. So that's an exciting conclusion of these circle ideas. Okay, so now I will now put everything in the framework of representation theory of purers. So it turns out that the cohomology of these pure varieties have a relationship with at least two kinds of representation theory. One is the representation theory of purers, and the other one, closely related, is the representation theory of Kac-Mundy algebras attached to those purers. So we will see both of them showing up today. Okay, so now I just give you this, I have given this a few times now, this very quick introduction to the basic ideas of representation theory occurs. In fact, this probably, in some ways, is the easiest representation theory, so you don't have to mess with groups and groups of structure and stuff. There is basically only linear algebra here, So we have a quiver, which is nothing. I mean, it might sound like scary, but it's just an oriented graph. We will assume connected. Okay, so we have some notation for this, the set of vertices. And we will have the name quiver comes from the fact that it's an oriented graph. So you can think of the oriented edges as arrows forming your quiver. Okay, that's the set notation we will have. The subset, in fact, you should think of this as a multi-subset because we can allow multiple edges. And as often we allow edge loops, but not everywhere. Or not in this token anyway. So edge loop just means an edge going to the same vertex. Okay, so we are going to study the representation theory over a field. And this field for today will be either the complex numbers, that might be our main concern, but it turns out if you want to understand representation theory of the complex numbers, it's actually much, it's a very clever idea to go over finite fields first. So we will then look at finite fields, or in some cases or some sense, we can also look at the algebraic closure. Okay, so what is a representation of a theory? Again, this is usually a difficult concept or a non-trivial concept. Even for groups, right, you know that the business I was doing last time, character theory of finite groups, Frobenius discovered character theory before representation, so it was not at all an obvious idea to look at representations. But for a quiver, the representation is a very easy idea. What we just do, we represent the quiver, I don't want to say it's a category, but somehow you have a vector space, finite measure vector space in every vertex, and then you have a linear map between those vector spaces along the oriented edges of the quiver. So it's a very simple idea of representation. Okay, so I'm just writing this down, as I said. Okay, just for, again, notational purposes, we will talk about the dimension of a representation, which is going to be a vector of integers encoding these dimensions of vector spaces. That's where all dimensions we leave. Okay, so then you start to study, you think about representation. So one thing, of course, you can always do, if you have two representations, you can form the direct sum. If you are less abstract, but in this audience, there's not many people, I guess, you can just think of that you have already a basis fixed at every vertex, and then the linear map is just a matrix, and then adding together representation just means forming these block matrices out of those smaller matrices. So I can add together representations, and vice versa. I can ask if I have a representation, can I write it as a non-trivial direct sum of smaller representations? And this is an obvious question, and we say the answer is yes or no. If it's the answer is it's no, so then it's what we call an indecomposable representation. And the cool thing that if you have any representation, if it's not indecomposable, then I can write it as the sum of two smaller dimensional representations. And again, you can continue this. I mean, smaller dimensional ones might be again possible to write them as a direct sum of smaller and smaller, etc. But because the dimension is always going down, eventually this process has to stop. So you will be able to write down any representation as a direct sum of indecomposables. And it's also not that hard, but you have to work, that this set of indecomposables appearing after the isomorphism is the same, independently of how you do this decomposition process. So in this sense, indecomposables will be the basic building of this representation theory. So it's natural to wonder what are the indecomposable representations. Even a naive question, which are the possible dimension vectors which support an indecomposable representation, is not trivial. You see, this is going to be a nice answer. You have a nice answer. So let me give you an example. Of course, you can always have very simple things like one-dimensional representations, then you just have a number of edges. But if you have a specific figure, then you see that the representations are really, that it is just linear algebra, for example, for the Jordan figure, we call it just a single loop along vertex. What is the representation? I have a finite vector space here, and I have an endomorphism of the vector space. And now you can think about decomposing this this vector space, this endomorphism, into this block diagonal forms of two isomorphism. You can take the matrix and you can conjugate it to an eventually over an algebraic Lipos field. We know it by the Jordan normal form. We can classify it by this Jordan normal form. And those blocks in the Jordan normal form are precisely the indecomposable representations. So an algebraically closed field, you have then you have these indecomposable representations, which are just individual Jordan blocks. Yeah, that's one that you understand again, that you then of course you can change, but otherwise, it will always have this form. And this up to isomorphism, and there is going to be as many indecomposables as elements you have in the field. Okay, that was very easy. And then you see that in this sense, this kind of theory is just generalizing the question of Jordan matrices. Okay, so again, the question is still the same. We want to know which are the indecomposables, say over C, or even which dimension vector support are indecomposable. And it turns out that there is a very efficient approach to this, is that instead of working over the complex numbers, you would want to ask the same question to the finite field. Because what's special about finite fields is that the number of indecomposables, if you just think in terms of matrices, the edges, and which one of them are indecomposables, there are finitely many of them, so you can count them. And this kind of count will be a very good approach to understanding what's happening. Okay, over a finite field, though, there is a slight slight complication, which is not present for complex numbers, namely that the field is not closed, but not algebraically closed. And so instead of just being interested in indecomposable representations, which you might, but over a non-algebraic you can even ask about absolutely indecomposable representations. So you can ask about the diagonal representation, some of these matrices, and you want it to be indecomposable, not over a cube, which could be indecomposable there, but you want it to be absolutely indecomposable over the algebraic closure. Okay, so I am just formulating this easy idea precisely here. And then it turns out that this is actually the right thing to count instead of indecomposables. You can also count indecomposables up to isomorphism, but the quantity you get that is less nice, and in fact it has less geometrical meaning. The really good geometrical object is this Scott's polynomial, which counts the number of absolute indecomposable representations of the cube. We're now on a fixed finite field, so it depends on cube of a given dimension vector alpha. So alpha is now a dimension vector moduli homomorphism. Okay, so this is some number, a function of Q. And of course, in these lectures, we always see that the kind of functions you see, like one to view, is polynomials. And this is the case here as well. So this was the first theorem of Patzov that introduced this perspective. And he did prove that that such number is a function of Q, it depends polynomial. That was one thing he proved. And the other one, which is also particularly interesting, that this number, although the set, of course, is different, but that the number, the cardinality is the same if you change the orientation of the figure. Okay, so that's great. So we have now this polynomial, he also shows, although I think we can show that much easier these days with our techniques, it actually has integer coefficients, but it's possible. So it has integer coefficients, in the, okay, here is now, for example, of the Jordan. Here I showed you the indecomposables over an edge rate with most field in case FQ bar, they have to be in the Jordan column for the single block. And now you are over FQ, so you want to write the value to be FQ, and there are Q elements in FQ. That's its name, so the trees. So you know that for every Q and every N, N is now a single number, which is the dimension vector for the Jordan quiver, you have exactly Q. Absolutely, the composite representations optimize more. And indeed, this is all the simplest polynomials in the machine, so it is indeed a polynomial. But that's really the kind of things which happen for simple quivers anyway. Later, it will get much more complicated. Okay, so what Katz was doing, then he computed these things over finite quivers and then finite quivers.
A stupid question. Can't you have a matrix over FQ that we get an absolutely indecomposable, but the item vector doesn't even mean FQ, right?
Yeah.
The eigenvector, like, once you get to the algebraic closure, you can put it into the canonical form, but then the eigenvalue might not be in the ground field. So couldn't you get more indecomposable?
The notion of the equivalence must go to the pass to the algebraic closure.
Right.
You're counting something modulo isomorphic.
Right, but we say the number is Q, right? Which is only those with the eigenvector.
No, but that's correct. So somehow what you're saying cannot happen. So if I have a matrix over FQ, can it be? Well, if it's of that form, then its trace is if you use large enough, then you the characteristic large enough, the trace is already giving you that number.
Maybe if the characteristic doesn't divide n or something?
Yeah, I'm sure there is n on such a thing. But it cannot happen what you're saying. Yeah.
Matrix 0, 1, 1, 0, enough to.
You know, that was the kind of example which could pull in for this argument. But this is a true statement. Okay. That's a good point.
Just an example, I guess.
Okay, so what he was doing then, he was looking at computations over finite quivers and affine quivers and one more. And then based on those, he formulated two conjectures, immediate conjectures. One was, I guess, his main reason to look at these problems. Polynomial, which we now call Katz polynomial, is a constant term, which is a very interesting number called the multiplicity of the root alpha in the Katz movie algebra attached to the quiver. I'll say a bit more words about this later. So anyway, this really gives a non-trivial connection to the representation theorem of quivers and the representation theorem of Katz movie algebra. In this case, we have to assume that there are no edge moves in them, so to be able to talk about the consequences. Then the other one, which would have been my conjecture, if I look at this result, because I wouldn't have spotted the multiplicity of the constant term, which has been noticing that in every computation, you might make your own isomorphic coefficients. Okay. So these are two conjectures, and then he went on, he sketched the whole eventual theory of trying to understand all these representations by parametrizing them in affine space. If it's a polynomial with positive coefficients, then maybe you might have a tiling, you might be able to exactly write down the absolutely the composite was parametrized by some nice set, but these are still out of reach, and I doubt this is going to be possible. But these two were interesting because they can be attacked, and they were attacked, in fact, and by now there are complete proofs for them. So the first big breakthrough was in this paper in 2004 by Crowley, Bowie, and Van Berg, that they already used ideas from quiver variety which I check it a little bit, I will sketch it a little bit later. So it says, restricting alpha to the case when alpha, we say, is indivisible, meaning that this dimensional vector, all the numbers in the dimensional vector have no trivial co-optimizer, so the divisor is 1. In that case, they prove the both conjectures. And you will see what's special about that in terms of the geometry soon. Okay, and now I'm trying to make some interest in the general conjecture that alpha might be divisible. And in fact, if you have any figure, you just multiply any dimension vector, non-zero dimension vector, maybe with an integer, and you will have infinitely many divisible ones. So, and in fact, at some point, at least after this paper, there were no like figures that the conjectures were one. Okay. So, now I'm going to give a little bit more detailed construction of what how you can construct these cubular varieties. And the reason I'm giving these details is because you will see that somehow the structure of the construction, the formalism we have will make the Fourier transform technical a finite field curve for some mysterious reason. So therefore I'm going to give you a general construction of linear symplectic quotient. So this is the case when you have a symplectic representation of a reductive group of the special form that it comes from an ordinary representation, which is doubly in the cotangent space to your representation. And then it is a valid on symplectic action, but in fact it turns out to be Hamiltonian. So you have your complex group acting on a finite dimensional vector space. We act in a, it's a representation, so it acts linearly. And then you can record the action as the group homomorphism from G to GLV. And this row is what we will remember from the action. And it will be important, so you have a homomorphism of groups. You can take the derivative and see what happens on the tangent space at the identity that is called the algebra, and you will have the algebra, what is called an infinitesimal action, the real algebra of homomorphism, from the real algebra of G to the real algebra of GLV, which is just the homomorphisms of V. Okay, so this is a real algebra homomorphism. Then, okay, this is going to be a symplectic vector space. If you want to talk about symplectic quotient, you want to take the quotient of this space, this symplectic vector space, this is the easiest of the symplectic vector spaces. There are the potential of the vector space. And then I am, again, just to be completely explicit, I'm writing down the symplectic form. These are important when you compute what is called the moment that you need to know precisely formulas, and I'm not going to do that, I'm just saying you. Okay, so then we will have this symplectic action of G on the symplectic vector space by doubling the representation, taking the dual representation on V star. And then it turns out that this action is Hamiltonian. If you have studied symplectic geometry, you know that this means that there exists. In this case, in this linear case, in this generative, you actually write down the moment map explicitly using this infinitesimal action, which you remember is a real algebra morphism from the real algebra of the group to the endomorphisms of the vector space, only of V. And then I'm just giving you a map, right? So the map from V times V star, the moment map, will have to map into the dual of the real algebra. So if we have to say where is for any given V and W in V times V star, we have to say which element of the dual of the real algebra began. The way how we will do it, we will evaluate it at a real algebra element X. And then this is the formula. So you look at this is in the real algebra of GX, and so I can take it to the endomorphism of my vector space on, with which I can act on the first vector V. And then I get another vector in V, which I can then pair with the covector W. It gives me an element in my field, I guess. I don't know what they say. So this everything is complex now. So Now, you know, when you do the symplectic quotient, if you remember, then the next thing is to take a level set of the moment at the level, but it has to come from the invariant part by G, because, okay, one important property of the moment map, which is true here as well, is that it's invariant with respect to the G action on the manifold and on the quadratic action of the algebra. So you have this invariant map. If you want to take the quotient of a level set, then you rather take an element in the invariant part of the dual of the algebra. So you take this psi, will be your level, and now we can form the linear symplectic quotient at level psi, and there's this function notation for that. You take the level set, and now because G acts equivariantly, the level set will be preserved by G. And so you can just take, this is an affine variety now, the level set. And so you just take the affine GIP quotient if you want to give an algebraic structure to that. So it's the affine GIP quotient. And that's our construction. So this is a general construction, and you will see that somehow this construction will be already very well placed to be able to do problems in the finite field. So that's why I'm telling you this general form, because somehow the movement map equation is particularly nice to solve, and trying basically what we were trying to find with the number of points of that view of the level set of the movement map. And we will see that Fourier transform is going to be the way to do that. Okay, but now let me give you, I will give you actually two examples. Both of them are sums of pure varieties. The one are some of the more general pure varieties, which are somehow closer to the idea of pure representations. So we will now look at symplectic pure varieties. So we will attach to such a quotient to any pure in the dimension vector. And we have a pure and a single dimension vector. Yes, and then to this we are going to first take the vector spaces of the dimension and the vertices. Okay, so we have this separated vector space. And then we can now take all of the potential representations of the cube, right? In representation of cubes, this is exactly the space we are interested in. We want to understand all the possible maps between these vector spaces along the edges of the, so the tail and the head, and then the tail of the cube, or the edge must be clear what it means. So you form, this is the space of all representations of the cubes, and in this theory, we really would like to understand the orbits of this under the natural automorphism. So what's the natural automorphism group? It's just taking all endomorphisms of these individual vector spaces that's meant to be an automorphism group. It turns out that the diagonal scalars are going to act trivially on this space. And if I have a multiply endomorphism from the left with the scalar, with the, so the inverse scalar from the other side, then it's not going to change the homomorphism. So that this trivial one is like trivially, but the rest is interesting. So if you take this quotient, it's going to be really your automorphism of the representations of others. And it's going to be now interesting to play this game of forming this linear symplectic quotient. And but you should remember, to do that, you have to double, what am I saying? Okay, I'm just explaining here this thing about the center. Okay, that doesn't matter. Okay, and so we will be eventually doubling the representation, but apparently before that, we have to think about the Lie algebra, because the Lie algebra is, of course, is going to be the Lie algebra of this group, and with this extra condition coming from this quotient, that the traces of the endomorphisms of the vector spaces at the vertices have to add to zero. And it's the sum of the algebra of the sum of these algebras. Okay, so now comes this idea that we this is really the automorphism group. So this group, of course, acts on the space of representations on the left and on the right. So basically, this is the representation that we like to understand, right? The orbits of this are the representations of the isomorphism. So that's the cool setup to have. And then we want to do geometry, so we will do this doubling procedure, and we will now take a quotient, and the quotient then has to be at some level in the invariant part of the algebra. And now we can form what is called a Hilbert variety. So a Hilbert variety is just such a symplectic quotient attached to a representation space of the Hilbert at some level, sorry. Okay, so that's a nice definition. It's going to be an affine variety by construction. It will have at its smooth points anyway a symplectic form. So it's a nice symplectic variety. Now comes this issue about being indivisible. And it turns out that precisely when the dimension vector is indivisible, then so in this case the center is going to be simple, like because it's going to be the center of each of these GLs, each of these GLs and the vertices. So if you have an invisible one, it turns out that you can always choose a psi in there, which is therefore now, if you have more than one vertex, this will be now a non-trivial space. And then it turns out that if it's an invisible dimensional vector, you can always choose a generic enough psi, so that the quotient is going to be non-singular. So both the level set of psi is going to be smooth, and then the action of the group will be free on that. So then you will get a nice quotient smooth space. And that's the reason why the Crowley-Bolt Gordon-Berry approach works in this case, because this variety can be made smooth. Because if it is divisible, then because of that thing, in some simple linear algebra, you can see that no matter what psi you choose, provided that it is not like the quotient is going to be non-empty or the level set is going to be non-empty, it will always have a scaling point. So you can never make it smooth in that case. Okay, so then when non-empty, the variety is non-empty, then it has a computable dimension into some, again, I'm not going to define this pairing on the dimension vectors, but some nice pairing, depending on the curve, you can compute the dimension. It's just easy, of course, to compute because you know what the expected dimension should be. The dimension of these vectors based on how to be minus two times the dimension of the group. So it's easy to compute. That's what you get. Okay? Then I will now sketch you the proof of the second conjecture of Katz, which in the case of Crowley and Bowie was somehow easier. So in that case, when alpha is invisible, the way how Crowley Bowie won the proof, Katz's second conjecture was by some nice geometrical argument, really, showed that in this smooth Hilbert variety, which a priori depends on psi, but it turns out that the number of points over a cube will not depend on psi, so the number of points on the Hilbert variety turns out to be basically this Katz polynomial of the Hilbert with that dimension vector. So you remember that the Hilbert variety knows about both the Hilbert and the dimension vector. So in particular, we know because Katz proved for us that it was a this is a positive non-negative number, so that this is a polynomial in Q. So this should be there for the E polynomial. And if you additionally can prove that the variety you have has a pure homology, then you know that this will have positive conditions, because it's basically just a cohomology supporting cohomology polynomial. And then M alpha is affine, so it has no chance of being semi-projective. You remember in semi-projective variety, we had this east direction, whose fixed point set was assumed to be proper. The affine varieties won't have trivial proper subsets. I mean, it could be isolated fixed points, maybe, but it is not the face of them semi-projective. But from what perspective, we could have taken the quotient at zero level, but took a non-trivial GIP quotient, and those things will be easily projected. So you would know those have been homology, and you can put them into family with these guys, and then you show, you can show that the homology doesn't change. That would be your perspective. Back then, I think it was Nakajima who wrote an appendix to that paper, which proved this crucial fact. Okay. And then when you have this, then you see that the E polynomial is really just a Poincaré polynomial, and then you have a beautiful geometry meaning for the Cotes polynomial, that it is just a compactly supported Poincaré polynomial of this FI singularity variety. And therefore, it has no negative coefficients. So that was, I think, a very nice geometric proof. And then the divisible case was hard there because there was no obvious variety, smooth variety to attach. And the variety is not smooth, so these arguments about purity came down. And also the geometrical relationship between pure representations and absolutely pure representations that breaks down as well. So basically, the basic techniques don't work in the case of alpha is divisible because the pure variety is singular. You're going to choose some generic amount. So in this case, what I'm just going to sketch this one, and I will spend more time on the first conjecture, because this part may be more technical, although conceptually may be easier to say how or proof. And what we did was that we invented a bigger figure, we embedded somehow. So you have your figure, some abstract graph, some vertices. What we did, we just added a long leg to every vertex x prime. So we have some figure inside. And then we studied the figure variety attached to this bigger one, and we put in dimension vectors. So if you had a dimension vector n, then it would be m minus or m minus, the full leg. We put the full leg at the vertex, and we managed to think about this bigger curve variety, because now these ones, the n is always a 1, it's always a divisible, indivisible dimension vector, so the total space of big point is going to be smooth. So what we did, we constructed this curve, which is roughly this, everything, we have many vertices, and we added a lot of long legs. Then we had constructed this dimension vector, which is set in birds. So if you had a dimension in here, you just count it down by 1. You would get the full leg. That's an alpha prime. And finally, the non-trivial thing to show was that the vial group, so you have a vial symmetry reflection at every vertex of the cuber. It acts on the cohomology of your cuber variety. It's a non-trivial nice construction. Going back to Nakajima. But if you just only took at the extra vertices you added, you take that part of the Y group, then it is just going to be a product of some symmetric groups. It's a nice group. And it is going to act on the cohomology of this big thing. And what we were lucky to find is that you know, you have these big products of symmetric groups acting on the cohomology of your pure variety, you decompose it into the divisible representations of your group, and in this case there is a unique non-trivial representation, sine representation for each symmetric group. You take the sine representation, you take the tensor product of that, and you get this one-dimensional representation of that group, non-trivial sine representation, and it turns out, this is what we managed to prove, that the component of the cohomology, which is the isotypical component corresponding to the sine representation, gives precisely the Cotes polynomial of the original figure. But this, we really used a lot of geometrical ideas about these wide loop actions and stuff. When I saw the computation, it showed this is less conceptual than the case of there. So they actually really have a map. This set and finders at that size. We don't have that. I mean, because because it's not on SF, right? This is just on the cohomology. So it's harder to begin with. Two, what we did is that just computing it. So anyway, that was nice because this is a bit more complicated, but again, this is some kind of gradient vector space. Some kind of vector space. And so its dimensions are not always non-negative. So that put the conjecture. And that was just about the easier to explain part of the second conjecture. I also wanted to say a few more words on the first conjecture, but also in the second conjecture, when we computed this thing, we used the same computational technique, this Fourier transform idea, which first I arrived at trying to do the same thing as Frobenius thing in the multiplicative case, but then also we paired up in the manner that we use cases about this kind of Fourier transform. So this was natural to do. So now let me explain this. So this implies the completes the conjecture too. Okay, and I'm going to tell you in a moment this Fourier transform idea, but I have to introduce another set of, again, the isopropyl varieties. I know as of the previous ones were studied by Nakajima, but some of these are the more famous or unpure varieties Nakajima studied, so I call these unpure varieties. And they come from not a single dimension vector as here, but another one as well. So now every vertex, this will be my example, the Jordan Pure, but now I will have two dimension vectors attached to a vertex, say dimension n and dimension m. And so at every vertex now you put two vector spaces. One is the usual kind, the V, which was similar to the one before. And then there will be this extra vector space, which you should think of as this frame vector space. We somehow frame the representations of the original pure V's, but we will have some also maps from W's to the V's, but only at the vertex. So the group is the same as before. It's only the going to be the not quite the same, right? Because we now no longer need to, or there's no reason to divide by the central subgroup. So we just take the whole of the automorphisms of the vector spaces. That's the same group. And now, instead of just the usual representations of the viewers, that's the usual representation for the SIV frame. It's now the vertex. I will have a homomorphism from this frame.
The root of the y is a positive.
And then it will be the, if all the w's are zero, then it's the same thing as before.
But you don't divide it by itself.
In that case, we should also be high. If there is one w which is non zero, then there will be no element which will act here, right? Because the point is that,
yes,
the scalars are here, but here they only. But it's enough that one is here. And indeed, the Nakajima thing will be empty. You will see in this construction, we will actually always take a quotient which is trivial in the case of the W's are zero. Yeah. Okay, so now we to. I call this holomorphic symplectic quotient because this idea comes from differential geometry. We use symplectic geometry, instead, we do this complex holomorphic way, but actually, we do everything algebraically, so probably better would be called algebraic symplectic quotient. Okay, so now I take that moment map construction by doubling this vector space with the action of G on it. And now I always take a particular element, the identity element, at every vertex. And it turns out that this is always going to be a regular value of the moment map. And then the group G is going to act freely on it. So here, somehow, it's easier to see that the quotient is always, there's no choice of sign now. It's an affine quotient, it's an affine Nakajima, right? It's always smooth, seems like algebraic symplectic, right? The answer is here, saying some computation about the dimensions of this. I just example, like examples. So is the Jordan up here, the two vector spaces, one of dimension n and the other one is dimension m. And then these are what I call the affine ADHF spaces. This is an interesting example because this was the first Hilbert variety study. This was before Nakajima, so it would be not called Hilbert varieties. But to get the honest ADHF space, again, you have to take the proportion to the zero level, and now you have to have a non-trivial polarization and take a non-trivial GID quotient, and again, the polarization in Nakajima's work is a fixed one, which somehow corresponds to this identity that we are. And that's a semi-projective variety, and that's the famous ADHF space, what AD, what here, Twitter, Fijin, and Rami constructed as the only space of SU and instantons on R4 always, there is some behavior in the individuals and behaviors. Okay. And the case when m equals 1, then you would note that this is like what you would do for the Hilbert scheme, but again, the Hilbert scheme is semi-projective, so it cannot be affine, it's not affine. So it's the somehow the affine deformation of the Hilbert scheme backwards on C2. This is called sometimes the curvature of the system, because it has some nice interval system structure as well. Anyway, these are two nice famous examples of Nakajima lines. Although the Hilbert itself too has a loop, and some of the things we want with cannot have loops, so it's maybe not the best. Okay, now quickly I sketch you the idea of trying to do the same kind of Frobenius formula compound for character varieties for these syntactic quotients. So we want to do a Fourier transform, which will give us the kind of Frobenius formula we were so successful in the character variety case. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you this Fourier transform. So we start, now everything is going to be on a finite field of Q. And the nice thing will be is that compared to the usual Fourier transform, everything is finite, there will be no convergence issues. So we just take the same formulas as the usual Fourier transform people do, but we don't have to care about convergence. What we have to care about, which is less obvious, what is the analog of the exponential function, which of course goes into the definition of Fourier transform. The role of the this function is going to be played by this entity character, so you take FQ as its entity structure, and then you find a homomorphism of this entity within a group into C star, and then you find a non-trivial such character, and you fix it. So there are more than one, but we just choose one of them, so you fix that, and then our Fourier transform is going to depend on that choice, or the choice of the exponent, the analog of the exponential function. Of course, the exponential function also has the same property that this is a trivial additive character of the additive of, say, the complex numbers to persist. Okay, so now what we are going to construct is the Fourier transform of a function on the finite set of points of the finite dimensional vector space over FQ to C. So the finite dimensional vector space of all such functions, I take one. And then we just define the Fourier transform by this simple formula, which again, if instead of the sum sign, you replace it with the integral, then it should be familiar here with the exponential. This is the usual formula for Fourier transform. Okay, so then to any function, you can construct this Fourier transform, and it has various nice properties, basically two main properties. We only use one now, is that if I do it twice, I take the Fourier transform, then I basically get back my original function up to some mild deformations, like an extra scalar comes up here, or which you could actually put in the Fourier transform definition, but this is one way to do that. Anyway, so that's going to be useful. Therefore, if you know the Fourier transform of your function, then you can know your function just by taking the Fourier transform again. So, okay, so that's great. Now, we are going to use this Fourier transform on this linear symplectic quotient set up over finite field. So now we have this V, which which is you think of this being over living over a finite field. I think my group now, we think of this as being over a finite field, so I'm going to act over FQ. But formally, over FQ or FQ1, you can do the same kind of algebraic geometry. We will have the action with the homomorphism. I can take the derivative, and this is just now the algebra homomorphism, etc. And then we have this formula, an explicit formula for the moment that I showed you before. Okay. So now we are going to do this over a finite field, try to, what we will be interested in, we will want to know the number of points of the level set of this moment map. Function which comes for any element here, not just the central ones, not just the invariant ones, where we really are interested in. It turns out you have to look at all of them, and then you will see that it will have a very nice way to transform that function. So now, not just for central ones, but any element in my the dual of the algebra, I will count the number of solutions of this moment map equation equally in that one, so the number of points. So this is my count function, which is this one. Count all the points, where the moment map takes the value of sine. Okay, and then the way to compute in this is to rewrite everything in terms of the delta function. Silly way, but because again everything is finite, I can do this. And the nice thing is that you can compute easily with the Fourier transform of these delta functions. And basically doing that, you get the it's actually a very simple observation. There is nothing to it. It's just a simple computation. To compute the Fourier transform of the count function is some very simple function. It's actually a function whose value is always just some q power and the number of points in the finite field, which is just some q to the dimension of the vector space, plus another q power, which is the number of points in a subspace of the algebra, right? Then I have to take the kernel. So the map is here. So the matrix for every x, I have an element here. So an endomorphism, I can take the kernel of that. So it's a subspace of V. And again, that's the statement. And as I say, it's a very simple computation. The only thing we use is just this formula for the moment map. And the nice thing now is so you computed the Fourier transform something, you find something nice, I mean this is really nice. And then to get back your count function, you just compute the Fourier transform again. So this way you get the count function. It's a simple function, it's the Fourier transform of this AO function. And the AO function is precisely this function which computes, which is always a q power, computes the kernel of these matrices. Where I x here, take the corresponding matrix and compute its kernel. It's a very simple function, this A function. Okay, it's easy. But then the very nice thing about such a computation is that you can effectively do this for non-computer varieties. It's not that part is not that straightforward. So in the computation, you reduce things to. So the computation is a Fourier transform on this Lie algebra, and then you reduce everything to the important elements in that Lie algebra, and then you realize some product formula which gives you the whole thing, and then you compute the important parts separately. But the nice thing is that the result only will work out nicely if you put together many of these opportunities. So now I give you the result of this computation, which was basically doing this Fourier transform for these two varieties, and then you get this giant generating function. So you fix the dimensions of the framing vector spaces, this additional independent vertex, and you let the original V's to vary. Then for each of them, you compute the cohomology of the Kuhler variety to the fixed W and then this varying V. You compute its Poincaré polynomial. This is the compactly supported Poincaré polynomial. There is S of U shift. I don't know And then here is a fraction which gives the result. So this is somehow the result of the important things in the denominator, and the numerator just comes from this in a simple shift with the W. So the denominator does not depend on the W. It's only depends on the V is that here, the W here is the numerator. It's a good combinatorial formula, but it's a combinatorial formula. So from this on, it's only a matter of computers and stuff to compute this. Because you take these selection functions, I can tell you what things are here, but very simple combinatorics. And this really, everything emerged from that simple idea to push this Fourier transform value for this query story. I give you some more details about what's what here, but I don't think it's really necessary to understand. What's crucial for the argument, because somehow the minimum dimensional homology of Nabokov, right, is the top non-vanishing homology, or in the case of completely supporting homology, the bottom non-vanishing homology. In this case, Q and I equals the dimension, so that is when Q equals zero, this is going to be a generic function of the middle dimensional homologies of Nabokov. So from this big formula, you will get an artificial way to have a formula for the Jenkins function, the middle dimensional homology of Nabokov-Kilever IDs. And you will see in a moment if you will have additional information about that, because that's where Nabokov constructive, all irreducible, highest weight, irreducible highest weight representations of the Katsuki algebra attached to the feeder. Okay, so two ingredients we will need for the proof of Katz conjecture one. One is, again, a nice combinatorial formula for the characters, if you like, of the highest weight irreducible representations of the Katz-Muri algebra. And I'm not going to tell you what it is. If the figure is finite, this is your usual semi-simple algebra. If it's an affine figure, then these are affine algebras. For more general figures, they will be really complicated in the dimensional. The algebras, and they are not even easy to define. Anyway, there are some analogs of finite dimensional V algebras attached to figures in these kind of cuts of the algebras. They have a nice highest state theory of representations, and in particular, there is a generalization of the Weyl character formula, which I'm giving. This is called the Weyl cuts character formula because it's the generalization of the Weyl character formula in the finite, like the semi-simple of the algebra case. Okay, so you take any irreducible representation corresponding to the highest state lambda, then you rewrite the representation into its weight spaces like that. Okay, and then if you have this, then you can write down this character of the dimensions of these weight spaces. So these will be typically infinite dimensional, and so but the weight spaces themselves will be finite dimensional. And this character formula gives us a formula of what the dimensions of these weight spaces are. And the formula is some combinatorial expression, but here appears the quantity which we are after. This M alpha, again, this is part of Kotze's theory. This is the multiplicity. It has a separate meaning, which I'm not giving it to you now. But you can think of this. These are the M alphas here after the multiplicities of the roots. They appear in the graphs that are denominator, which are typically now going to the infinite products compared to the finite dimensional things. Okay. So this is some formula in representation theory we will use. And the other one is a geometrical result of a geometric representation theory designed by Nakajima, who constructed these representations on the middle cohomology of Nakajima Kubert varieties. So then these highest weights are on one-to-one correspondence with these W's. So to a W, we have this highest weight, lambda W. And we are going to construct an irreducible, or not we, Nakajima, constructed an irreducible representations of the Katz-Muri algebra of highest weight lambda. Mary, you fix W and you let me into anything. You take all these language parameters, right? You state them in homology. And on this, he constructed the representation explicitly using some convolutional formulas. And now, if you put this together, these two results, then we have this representation. We know it's a character formula. So we have now an independent formula for the cohomology. So the middle cohomology, middle Betti numbers of Nakajima-Pillo, right, is satisfying this combinatorial formula, where now this M of us we would like to relate to the Katz polynomial here. And this is the way to put things together, because now I can put things together to really give some sketch, maybe the proof of the first Katz projection. You can see how all these ideas interact. So the Weierkatz Nakajima formula plus now our main formula, we call we have this formula about the generic function of all Nakajima, remember it is all homologies, but taking Q equals zero gives us precisely the generic function for the middle Betti numbers. So that's what this Weierkatz Nakajima formula gave us. That if I take this one's my formula for the Poincaré polynomial when Q equals zero, this gives me the changing function for the middle cohomology by Nakajima. It has representation, the highest degree representation of the Katz-Mudi algebra, so by the Weierkatz character formula, that has such a great decomposition like that. So you get some equality like that. Then we are good now because we will see soon that the A polynomial is hidden in the denominator there. Okay. To do that, first thing we want to say is that if I let here we have a free W. We really are interested in a fixed figure with a fixed dimension vector, but we have a free W, and it turns out that if you send somehow W to infinity, and explicitly you can just take one everywhere, every dimension vector for W, and then you just multiply it with M, the same M, and then you let M go to infinity, you can show that the numerators in both expressions somehow infinity, so you will find that the denominators have to agree. And for the denominator here, we will see a very nice connection with the Katz's A polynomial. So here is Katz's A polynomial written down in terms of coefficients, is Ti alphas. Then now we can conclude that the denominator here should agree with the Q equals zero specialization of this formula, which for us really from nothing appeared in this Fourier transform thing. But it turns out that this is also this formula in the denominator is the so-called the left-hand side of the so-called Hua formula. So the Hua formula is basically was done by Katz and Stanley in the original paper, but they didn't conclude. They just wanted to see that the A polynomial is a rational function, and they conceived. But Hua completely pushed it to an actual formula, and he found that the A polynomials are somehow encoded here in this. This is the same kind of X and log bay in this platistic exponential business we did for character varieties. Anyway, I just don't want to write that, so I just this simple nice formula, which remembers all the Ti alphas, all these coefficients of the A polynomials can be computed. And again, it is also similar to our kind of left-hand side, right? It's just a partition of the dimension vector at every vertex. You have a vector of partitions, and then you have a similar simple formula. Okay, so now you know that this thing agrees with the Q equals zero part of this, but here it's easy to take Q equals zero. It's just singling out the constant terms, and this is going to be the Q equals zero part, because this part has to be zero, I plus J has to be zero. And now, two agrees, and from that you can conclude that M alpha indeed equals the constant term. Okay, so anyway, I just wanted to give you basically my contribution was just to compute the Betti numbers of Nakajima-Pillo varieties, the rest is putting together the results from the literature. And then that gave the proof. So, very good. So, I have even 10 minutes, but I guess I went faster. I have one more slide to discuss. A very nice global version of this Katz polynomial business, which was that which yielded the first closed formula for the Betti numbers of X-Mudi space. this is due to only the shift one, and it was done or published in 2016 maybe, but then probably in 2015. So the idea is, which Bishop had done today, or to try and things like that, because I told you that we got to the pure varieties from the character varieties, and we were honestly interested in Higgs bundles anyway, and even for Higgs bundles, you could see connections to pure varieties, but the way how Olivier managed to do things was really remarkable. So what he does, he introduces the analog notion of absolutely the composable representation of the pure. So the idea is that we replace the pure with a curve, and we will think of a representation of the pure as a vector bundle over the curve. I mean, there are even categorical analogies. I think most of them are probably one category or something like that. So somehow these are very similar categories. So you can ask the same kind of question over a finite field. So let's assume the curve is defined over a finite field. So you can talk about vector bundles over the curve over the finite field. It makes sense to say absolutely the composable, which in this algebraic geometry language is just geometrically the composable, meaning that if you exchange to the algebraic closure, that vector bundle there becomes in the composable, which just means it's not a direct sum of two smaller vector bundles. You fix the rank and the degree, and then you will have half twice more because of finite in any such vector bundles. I'm sure it's clear. And you can count this, and this is going to be now a function of Q, but dependent on C. Now, the dependence on C will not be just through its genus. The genus is recorded there. Let me show you an example. So, the easiest example is the rank one case, because what do we do? The rank one, there is no, the condition is vacuous, everything is going to be composable in rank one. So, you really are counting up to isomorphism nine bundles of, say, degree zero or any degree, any fixed degree over the curve. So, it's like counting points on the Jacobian or that it has a very nice formula for the count. And this is the formula. And these alpha i's are the so-called value numbers. Abstractly, you can say these are some of the eigenvalues of Frobenius acting on the first homology of the curve, the attack homology of the curve, or something like that. But they also explicitly show up in the famous formula on which Val proved, and he based on his Val conjectures based on that. If you count the number of FQ or FQ to the endpoints of your curve, and you form a training function with some Q to the SSC, some variable form. This is again not unsimilar to our kind of Lattice thesis, sometimes the exponential. Then you get the so called zeta function of the curve, and the zeta function sees the cohomology of the curve in this very precise way, then you will see the zero degree two homology, and here on degree one homology is the alpha i's show up, which are exactly the eigenvalues of Frobenius on attack homology. So these are somehow inscribed in the arithmetic of the curve. You get these their numbers. And so you see, in particular, when the rank is one, that the result is actually a polynomial in the their numbers. Now you should know that these Val numbers come in pairs, and that product is Q. So Q is there as well, so somehow the Val numbers generate Q. So previously we said things are polynomial in Q. Now we will be saying things are polynomial in or Olivier is saying things are polynomial in the Val numbers. And that's his first result, which is the analog of Patsy's theorem that it is polynomial in the Val numbers of C. Then he goes on and he manages to find in a complicated way in the first paper, then he has a later paper with Moskovoy, where he managed to simplify the argument to show that the same kind of Crowley Bowie show business works, and so, you know, Crowley Bowie bonded by business works, and you can relate the aid that this noble version of Pythagoras polynomial now with the high particular version of the monetary space of factor functions that is what his model. So his second main result is that the Poincaré polynomial already is formalism related. It's the polynomial with the compactly supporting the homology of the Poincaré polynomial. The Higgs mu space, which you now recall, is a semi projective variety. Therefore, it's really the same as the polynomial. It has this very nice formula. So you take this polynomial in the real numbers and then show them in the substitute T, and here is your formula for the Betti numbers of the Higgs mu spaces. Okay, this is still not computed, but it's put in the same kind of framework as what is polynomials. And the hardest part of the paper was into actually computing these polynomials. And this is basically finding the analog of Huas formula, but things are much more complicated because the stack of all representations in that case, the stack of bundles, it's not something is not finite, it is infinite in many points, so he has to truncate those stacks, and he really has to invent a lot of logical stuff. He uses whole algebra representations, Eisenstein series, things he had done before, and eventually he manages to get a closed formula, the first closed formula for the Betti numbers of the Higgs mu spaces. So this formula has an advantage and a disadvantage. The advantage is that it's a theorem. The disadvantage is that it's even more complicated than our conjecture. And so, at this point, I don't think this theorem, we don't yet know if it agrees with our conjecture. So his is much more complicated. I think it was computed for his two, where it matched with whatever the conjecture. But it's much harder. There are, besides the same sort of statistical logarithm business, exponential business, there is also residue formalism, iterated residues, that's the kind of thing I will talk next time. And actually, it's a very complicated. So it's really a beautiful result, the first closed formula. And I mentioned last time that now there is a claim by Maulik and Pinkston, so we might have another closed formula, but that is closer to fine art, because that will be hopefully the programming conjecture. Okay, and let me finish with a little discussion on one of the interesting conjectures of Schiffmann, and he's conjecturing that this is independent of D. So it's not even the case of, course, I should have said, oh, this is only in the case, just like, so the D and N being co-prime is analogous to this indivisible and divisible business in the clear variety case. But here he's claiming or conjecturing, which works for the small cases he would compute, that the result is independent of D. So even if D is not co-prime to R, this sound should be the same independent of D. It's really, really remarkable. And this, of course, all comes back to this original observation, which was made in this one by Daniel Alcock, that the Betti numbers of the character varieties should be independent of D, because it's a much stronger version of that. Of course, if this is independent of D, then the Poincaré polynomial will be independent, but these are somehow almost the whole of T, because it's the count of any finite field of the curve. Yes, and I now maybe I can mention, hopefully, the recent result by two of my students, Michael Dershin, an ex-student, and they introduced my present student at Paul Ziegler. They did a periodic integration along the fibers of the Higgs map, and they proved a topological neurosymmetric conjecture. And I hope they as well believe that it will actually prove this statement, at least compared to, I mean, there is a statement about the FP points of the Higgs mu space, and that statement will follow the independence of the from there. So we will see. But again, this finishes the talk. Thank you.
some not. If I want to actually know the numbers, like I want a computer program to do it, which scheme is the fastest?
Well, I don't think this one was. I mean, that's one thing about these formulas. Our formula is in the computer. So.
And how high can you go with that formula?
Well, if you just want these basic ones, then you only have G, R, and R and G, I think we went up to. We had this paper where we looked at very big examples, so we did compute very big. I think we fixed G to be 2, and I'm sure we went up to R is 10. And it's really now, I mean, this exponential business is not trivial, but if it's programmed cleverly, and it was not time, so it was programmed cleverly, but it said it was going, then you have an efficient way to compute things. But as I told you, the other amazing aspect of that, we did not know that the result was a polynomial in the formalism. We now know this by Anton Bennett's book from last year. And hopefully, by this result I already mentioned, we know that this is the correct result. But we have formulas for 10 parameter variables or X bodies and SO variables. So we know what the Betti numbers should be.
Other questions? So, when you made your extended thing, what if you just wipe one step and use it? So, you have another minus one, that would be relatively prime and you'd do something smooth.
No, that's true, but. Okay, my hunch is that I need for the whole while loop here. So I need Sn minus 1 equals Sn. That way you won't only have a set 2 action. I don't think that we know about the polynomial figure. But I might be. I'm sure otherwise we would have the same thing.
Okay, well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Thomas again.